news, Labour Party in Britain and so on. But we're going to go from the international to the national to the local, and there are some ballot questions here in Massachusetts we're going to talk about Oliver Stone's new movie, and again, the elections. And I know a lot of you are kind of getting sick of that, but don't be. It's going to be over soon. And the elections are actually an interesting time. There are people sort of paying more attention to politics, warts and all. And there's a lot of warts, obviously. Both Trump and Hillary are not offering anything for working people. And the Republican Democratic parties never do. But that's a hard lesson to learn. It takes a lot of experience. And it takes having an alternative. And this show isn't named Socialist Alternative for nothing. We're about the business of building an alternative. As you know, we have gotten elected Shama Sawant to a major city council position in Seattle and re-elected, actually. So there is an open socialist, member of Socialist Alternative, named Shama Sawant, who is sitting right now giving the status quo and the people in power a real headache and getting some really good things passed, like a $15 an hour minimum wage, which we were crucial in doing. Shama was crucial in getting that passed, and Socialist Alternative and many others. And that is happening as well in Minneapolis, where we almost won a seat on city council, but we got this $15 minimum wage bill almost on the referendum. The Republicans and the Democrats kind of joined together and stopped that from happening this election, and that's sad. But the movement now has a lot more allies, and it's polling very, very well. So I think Minneapolis, Minnesota will be one of the cities soon to follow Seattle and many others now, with a $15 an hour minimum wage, which enormously helps people, obviously. To those of our listeners like myself that are struggling paycheck to paycheck, day to day, the precariat, and so on, you know what that can mean. A few dollars extra per hour can really give you a lot more choices, as they like to say when they talk about capitalism. Lots of choices in capitalism, yeah. Choices if you have the money. Very few choices if you don't. Let's get back to the main point, the top of the hour story, so to speak, that the Boston Globe, the Boss's Glob, and the Boston Herald, and I don't have a funny nickname for that sad rag, they didn't bother to even talk about. And that is yesterday, a rally of over 1,000, mostly union members, but also community supporters and others, workers of all type, youth, students, supporting the Harvard University dining hall service workers that are on strike. Again, it's over 750 workers on strike. Let me get the exact number there, because I did write an article about it. Yeah, everyone's using 750. And that is a lot of workers at the richest university in the world who have, and this university has chosen to basically nickel and dime, if you know that old expression, every single union on campus, including the union that I'm in. My union leadership, unfortunately, took some concessions on health care without even putting up a fight, no protest, nothing. And that has led, that put some wind in Harvard sales, unfortunately, in Harvard management sales. And they're going after these very low paid dining hall workers and saying, you must pay for more of your health care. And there's no reason for it. There's just no reason for it. Harvard has more. It's the equivalent of pennies for Harvard. This is an institution with a $35 billion endowment. And everyone focuses on that, as they should, because that's a chunk of change. And it's not all earmarked. It's not all set aside for certain specific uses. I've researched it. There's a lot of unencumbered endowment funds, a lot of endowment funds that are not set aside that they can use however they want. But that's just a corner of the story of Harvard's immense Moloch-like wealth. They have money coming in from cash gift donations that don't even go into the endowment. Every school is allowed to collect its own little pot of gold. So the Harvard Business School, for example, has its separate fund of gifts, quote unquote, and that's money. That's huge, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars donations, adding up to billions. In fact, Harvard's on a fundraising drive. I'm unclear if this money is earmarked for the endowment or not. I have a feeling it's not. They just went on a fundraising drive, a three-year fundraising drive, or maybe 5 years. They've already gained in 2 years of the drive $5 billion. Or $7 billion, and they're going to $9 billion, or it's 5 to 7 or 7 to 9. And again, I'll come back with that statistic in a minute if I have time to look for it. But the point is, on top of that $35 billion, now you're talking $5 to $7 billion more, ultimately $9 billion. They're very confident because money chases money, money follows money. And so Harvard's considered a safe bet and a worthy institution by people that want to see this, you know, ruling class continue to rule. And then Harvard is part of that essential education for a part of the ruling class, you know. And having said that, by the way, though, I have to say, reality is contradictory. We have a lot of students at Harvard supporting the strikers. There's been a petition circulated by SLAM, the Student Labor Action Movement at Harvard, which has been around since the Living Wage sit-in in 2000, which I supported and played a tiny, tiny role in. But anyway, supported it and helped it along as much as I could, along with other members of Socialist Alternative. That SLAM came out of that and has remained intact ever since and been a very great voice for student labor solidarity at Harvard. And they circulated a petition with 3,800, I'm not sure if it was just students, but 3,800 people, probably maybe students, alumni, I'm not sure, signed this petition. And Harvard undergrad's quite small, you know, that's so that 3,800 is a lot. It's more than I think the undergrad population or about equivalent to it. Adding grad students is a different story. There's a lot of grad students at Harvard and so on. But so you have SLAM, a good amount of solidarity. There's students on the picket lines. There's students signing this petition. There's students bringing food out to the strikers. There's students, spending a lot of time doing support work. And if it's like the Living Wage sit-in, you're going to see more and more whining from certain students, the more conservative wing at Harvard. You never get 100% support, but I'd say, if I had to guess, I'd say definitely a majority of students support the dining hall workers right now. And also, the dining hall workers at Harvard that are on strike, they're not calling for a boycott of, like, all the dining halls. Perhaps they should. That's debatable. But you basically have some dining halls remained open. Some have been closed. And the students are still eating, although it's worse food, as they themselves have said. And Harvard using scab labor in the form of a few scabs that have crossed the picket line. Harvard Crimson student newspaper estimates 14 scabs across the picket line. I don't know if it's that many, really, out of 750 or whatever. It's horrible, but I don't think it's even that many. But also Harvard's asking mid-layer management or upper-layer management that to volunteer to come in and help serve rotten frozen food stuff that's not very good to the students to keep things running during the strike, when actually Harvard should just months ago settled this whole thing without a strike for the equivalent of pennies. So the workers wouldn't have to pay more in health care. So they would have decent wages. They're asking for a $35,000 minimum wage, basically. And they're asking for work. The whole thing is Harvard publishes, every strike I've been close to. Like, I went on strike one time when I was working in a factory in upstate New York, and the minute we went on strike, the local papers were totally exaggerating how much we made in wages and benefits. Just total exaggeration. They're doing the same thing with the dining hall workers at Harvard, using averages instead of median figures, using just making it up as they go along to make it seem like why would the workers be not interested, you know, why would they be upset at all? Why couldn't they handle increased costs? Well, the reason is they just can't. They don't make enough, actually. Harvard's lying about that. They basically, in the Boston area, the cost of living is so great with the huge rents, rent increases, the huge cost of childcare, huge cost of anything you want to think of, basically, is inflated in this metropolitan area. So the workers can't handle. They're already paying a huge amount for health care, especially family health care. And many workers don't even qualify for the health care. It's too expensive. They can't even get on the health care because they realize they couldn't pay the high premiums and so on. They couldn't take the cut in their check, the cut in the pay that goes in their check every week or 2 weeks or whatever. So, but to make matters worse, there's 4 to 5 months where a lot of the workers don't even work. So whatever they're making per hour and per year, and don't believe Harvard's figures, the dining hall workers at Harvard, most of them, almost all of them, spend months at a time where they get nothing. They get no pay whatsoever. And they also don't get unemployment. And I don't know how the state, run by the big corporations, obviously, how the corporate politicians have managed to screw Harvard workers out of getting unemployment. But somehow they manage that. and they don't get unemployment. They good luck finding a part-time job for that small amount of time, especially one that would pay what they're used to, which again isn't that much, but it's better than walking into a fast food job. And then on top of that, they used to get other work during the summers. And I believe it was usually, at one point at least, commensurate, you know, to what they were used to getting paid. And for their regular work. And so now they're just asking for that back. They're asking for work over the summer at pay that they can handle. And that's equivalent to their regular pay. And also the thing with the Harvard strike is that just the obvious resonance it has among most working people. Here's Harvard, as I started to get into its vast web of wealth, its huge amount of money, and what that does to the, you know, to see, you see the picture of the dining hall workers out of a job right now, I mean on strike, and trying to just get a decent, you know, just keep the, hold the line on healthcare costs, which are already too much, get a base salary going. They're asking for 22% raises over, a 20% raise in pay over 5 years. Do the math, right? That's less than 4%. And they're asking for, basically, again, this summer work that they used to often get. So it's not, for Harvard, that's the equivalent of pennies, but Harvard is dug in. Why is Harvard dug in? You ask yourself. Well, many of you know the answer. The rich get rich. The big corporations get bigger, not by paying any attention to human need or human morality or what's just or what's fair, what's right or what's nice. They get by greed and ruthlessness, and they go through the situation and they see where the vulnerabilities are, where are the weakest people, and they go after them. And then they go after the next weakest, and then pretty soon they're going after everybody. And when my union leadership caved on the healthcare, it was like a shark scenting blood. Ah, now we're going to go after all the other unions and their healthcare, in the race, and add them to the race to the bottom. And, you know, Harvard at this point is probably, you know, fantasizing about busting the union, you know, and I think that is a fantasy. I don't think that's going to happen. The union is strong. The support is strong. There's a good chance of winning. What I argue in an article I just wrote, and I hope it gets published at some point, is that, look, Harvard is vulnerable itself, and they're vulnerable to the PR. They're vulnerable to real solidarity. Bring out on strike other unions, you know. We could really have real solidarity would be solidarity strikes, solidarity job actions. There's been a little bit of that. I don't mean little in like not good. I'm just saying that not enough unions participating. Very good solidarity from Teamsters Local 25 refusing to deliver food over across the picket lines. Very good solidarity from IBW Local 103, which has stopped some work here and there. On you know, Harvard's doing a ton of building and remodeling. In case you haven't noticed, if you haven't driven around there lately or been around there lately. It's amazing how much the universities in the Boston area just gobble up neighborhood after neighborhood and land parcel after land parcel and stomp their, put their mark on everything and own everything. And Harvard's doing that. Harvard got rid of a whole housing project in Alston, as their expansion goes into a neighborhood called Alston near Cambridge, bordering Cambridge over the Charles River. They did replace the units, or got someone to replace the units or something like that, but still, dislocation, et cetera. Amazing amount of money they're spending on everything except the people that make the money for them, the workers. Labor creates all wealth. Harvard is no exception. Students need to eat. These workers play a key role. The students actually acknowledge that, a lot of them. They say, you know, the food is really bad. The lines are really long right now. It's not what they signed up for. You know, at Harvard, obviously, right? And with all that money, they expect better conditions. But also, and this is interesting, think about it, the workers are really nice to them, and they miss that. You know, for some students that are far away, and Harvard tries to get this like smattering of students from different geographical locations and so on. The dining hall workers were like nice to them. You know, cut through the alienation of the being brand new and not knowing anybody. And they see them, imagine seeing the same people 3 meals a day, you know, that gets to familiar with the person, you know, that hopefully there's a little friendship there, a little acquaintanceship at least. And there is. And the students acknowledge that. And they miss it with the scabs or weirdo, strange managers trying to sling this frozen hash now. So getting back to the original point, and if you're a regular listener of Social Alternative Radio, you know we have amazing fact-filled digressions for you, but also we do get back to the original point, usually sooner or later. Two points, actually. Harvard's money trail, but secondly, that yesterday there was a big rally. So before we get into the rally, sponsored by the Massachusetts AFL-CIO, by the way, before we get into the rally, I just wanted to mention that the Harvard's money trail, just I'll give you some headlines, right? So there's the endowment, which everyone focuses on, and that's good to have some focus on that because it's the biggest endowment in the world of any university. Harvard is the richest university in the world, and they're screwing over these workers that hardly make anything and that are essential to Harvard's functioning. And that's you should be outraged. If you're not angry about that, you're lacking empathy and you really have to rethink a lot of things, okay? If you are angry about it, get down to Harvard and join the picket lines. Usually around the best time to go would probably be lunchtime, you know, around noon, 12:30, 1, or in the evening around 5, 4:35, 6. Look for the picket lines. There's always one at Annenberg, which is next to the Science Center at Harvard, at the corner of Oxford and Kirkland, sort of over Cambridge Street, if you're familiar with the area at all, and join the pickets, and you'll be welcome. Make a donation of money, make a donation of food or water or something. The union is trying to pay the strikers $40 a day. I know one courageous striker who's on principle not taking the money from the union and toughing it out so other people can have more. And that's, you know, you can help. You can also just harass the crap out of Harvard right into the, you know, just do a search and find the biggest manager at Harvard you can find. Doesn't even have to be related to the dining hall service. Harvard Corporation, you know, right to the CEOs, you know. I mean, I don't believe in like petitioning and writing as the be all and end all, obviously, of political struggle. What really has to happen here is solidarity from other unions in a much bigger sense. But also what has to happen here is occupation. The dining halls now have to be occupied by the workers, by their supporters, by students, and that it has to be shut down, and there has to be that kind of level of solidarity and that kind of level, frankly, yes, of confrontation. And of course, a lot of union leaders hate that word. They want to feel they have the same values and everything is management, and they don't. The power of the union comes from the members, and it comes from job actions, and it comes from strikes and solidarity and all sorts of tactics that rely on the membership, not high-level negotiations with lawyers and suits. That's after the fact for a real union. For a real union, it's the class struggle. It's down on the ground. It's can we mobilize the members of this union and other unions, et cetera, and it's time to occupy. It's time to occupy. And that is what will get Harvard to settle and occupy. You know, I don't know what the targets. The targets could be the dining halls, could be the CEOs when they meet to a Harvard Corporation. It's run by the way, you know, corporate CEOs. It's not academics for the most part. Sometimes they have one or two academics on the board. Maybe that should be the target. Maybe Mass Hall, the target of the living wage in 2000. Time to escalate to occupation. And get more strike action, more job actions going. And on top of this, there's the situation, like I started to say, of just the basic unfairness of it all. And it gets really, really angering when you find out more about Harvard's money. So there's the endowment, there's the donations I talked about that don't necessarily end up in the endowment. Big, huge cash donations that can go to individual schools, that can go to special projects. People can donate money to Harvard, a non-tax-paying, so-called non-profit institution, even though they have stock in all sorts of corporations, oil, forests. They own forests, they own parking lots, they own hotels, they own oil, stock in oil companies, et cetera, et cetera. They're very heavily invested in just basic big capitalist enterprises. I don't know where they get the non-profits that's from. It's just a tax dodge, sort of like the Catholic Church and all the rest of those non-profits that shouldn't be. And so they abuse the nonprofit status. They don't pay taxes, and at the same time, they're invested in businesses making a ton of money, and that money is going to, making more money, basically. Now, unlike a publicly held corporation, that doesn't necessarily go to stockholders. The rich and powerful that can buy up a lot of shares of stock, that money does, yes, go to inflated salaries, a bloated upper management. Yes, yes, yes. There's people getting rich off of big Harvard salaries, administrators and the president and all that stuff. Absolutely. So there's an element of corruption and greed there. Absolutely. Money managers that make millions of dollars, et cetera, that are just speculating Harvard's endowment funds, which proves, by the way, that's not all earmarked for some sort of academic purposes or earmarked at all. They have free-floating venture capital that they hire people to invest and make a lot more money. But think about, go down the food chain a little bit to still significant money that comes in from Harvard from not endowment, not gifts, meaning cash donations to non-endowment things, funds and so on, but also rents. Harvard owns a ton of property to own that businesses rent out, property that private individuals rent out. They get a ton of money from that. They get money from the government. There's government programs, all sorts of programs that Harvard is the target of, in the sense of the government's hiring Harvard to do something, research or something like that. All that money. There's all the little fees Harvard charges for everything. Fees that hit me and other workers, fees that hit the students, fees that hit the public when they interact with Harvard on a superficial basis, but an expensive one. Not just in terms of, not just rents, I'm not talking about moving away from rents, I'm talking about just like fees for every little thing you think of. And then there's the sort of, you can throw this in the fee category or not, but there's like room and board, you know, set aside tuition, there's room and board. There's all these things you have to pay when you're a student. And then there's tuition. Now, there's a certain amount of students that get some financial aid, and Harvard brags about that. But still, that's Harvard could be doing so much more in financial aid, so much more. It's not even funny. And then we have things like licensing fees when something comes out of a Harvard enterprise of some sort, a scientific thing or whatever, then there's licensing fees coming out of that. There's branding fees. I mean, the fee thing can cover just so much. It's just unbelievable. Tuition, room and board, rents, things that they just sell directly, you know, and on and on. There's all these streams and money streams coming into Harvard as a big corporation that they don't have to be very transparent about, because they are a privately held corporation. They are not issuing stock, right? So again, that's less of an expense when you think about it. Not only are they not issuing stock, they're not issuing dividends to stockholders. So they're just amassing more and more money with minimal costs. And then there's, think about this one. I haven't even mentioned this yet, but people have calculated this stuff down to the penny. Almost. Well, actually, they can't, because, again, Harvard is very opaque, very not transparent in its money. But there's the interest on these vast billions and millions of dollars sitting around Harvard. Interest payments alone on the endowment could take care of not only the needs of the hotel and dining hall workers, the dining hall workers at Harvard, they're part of the hotel, Unite HERE Local 26, which includes hotel and restaurant workers. But it could, every union on campus could have double what it has through just the interest on the endowment. That's the kind of money we're talking about. In fact, the math is so, gets into, you know, figures so large that it's hard to, for people, including myself, to really wrap your head around, and Harvard depends on that. They like making things confusing, like making things seem, of course this money can only go to there, or that money can only go there. And it's all bull. It's all wrong. A few years ago, quietly, this didn't happen in public for the most part, the non-unionized faculty was able to get its act together enough, and they really need a union, but they were able to get their act together enough at Harvard to say, look, you're starving the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. You're not giving enough money to the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. So they made up enough of a fuss, and some other, some of the unions got a little restive about that, a little energized about that, and there was just sort of this murmur that, yeah, I mean, they're putting all this money into developing other things, real estate and grabs in Austin and so on, and the basic core is suffering. And by the way, if you ever get a glimpse into the Harvard student life, the fact that they have to go to these big lecture hall things and so on is kind of a ripoff, by the way, even within that parameter. But they'll suffer anything for that Harvard degree, which is like a big credit card to the ruling class. But anyway, they are basically in a situation where there's times where they veer far away from the basic academic thing, and they just basically attack people. I'm sorry, what I was going to say was they basically starve literally people and programs to the point where there's some little bit of fight back, and there was, and like overnight, really, this hardly got going. Overnight, they loosened the spigot and put millions of more dollars into the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. You know, I mean, there's no natural law here about how Harvard can spend its billions of dollars. They try to make it pretend like there is. So they're screwing over the dining hall workers. Yesterday, rally of over 1,000 people, AFL-CIO rally and march. And I'll get into that a little more. I'm going to take a quick break. You're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. And we're gonna hear something from New Model Army, and we'll be right back.
No lies. We touch each other, yes, but only with our eyes.
New Model Army, what a wonderful way to go. Tufts, free-form, commercial-free, community-based radio. And if you're a regular listener to Social Alternative Radio, you know we are working our way through that New Model Army Original 20, it's called, album. For quite a while. We like it. We love it. We used to watch, we used to see them when they came to the States back in the olden days. TT and the Bears, Central Square. Yes, we were all punks at one time, I guess. So yesterday's rally in support of the Harvard dining hall worker strike. I can't say enough about this, as you can tell, because this is 750 workers that deserve a settlement yesterday from Harvard, the richest university in the world. In fact, I'm looking at this leaflet from the union that basically says, look, strikers have two demands from the richest university in the world. People who work at a school with $35 billion should earn at least $35,000 a year. See the symmetry in the numbers there? See the injustice. Harvard should not make taking our kids to the doctor more expensive. Support the strike rally, which was yesterday. And quoting from the Harvard Crimson, a well-funded daily newspaper from the corporation I work at, I like the Crimson this year. The Crimson has, believe it or not, they take these votes, right, on the editorial board of the Harvard Crimson, and usually they're very irritating votes. Usually the majority has a rotten position, the minority has a good position on a lot of things, a lot of social justice issues. That has flipped itself this year, and we have the majority of the editorial board of the Harvard Crimson supporting the strike of the dining hall workers at Harvard. And there's other little glimpses of things like that happening at Harvard right now. Faculty, a lot of faculty in support of the strikers, a lot of students. I mean, there's a certain number of students at Harvard that are, you know, working or upper middle class and getting financial aid, and that's a good thing. But it's very much more limited than Harvard leads you to believe, and there's a lot of legacy students. So when you see, like I said earlier, 3,800 students and maybe others, but I think mostly students, signing a petition in favor of the dining hall workers, when you see students out picketing, which they're not used to, you can tell, some of them. But all the picket lines have a lot of drumming and singing and stuff, so they're very militant in a way and fun in a way. Although this is a deadly serious strike for a lot of people. I mean, I've been on strike personally. Everything, it's a free fall. You can lose your home. You know, you don't make the mortgage payments, you lose your home. You can't afford to go to the doctor, this and that. It's deadly serious, and yet you also feel this exhilaration. You're taking on this this unjust corporation. You're feeling your power. You see that, like at Harvard, you see the dining hall shut down. I mean, I guess we do the work. I guess labor does create all the wealth, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, back to the rally. This was pretty well attended, over 1,000. I'm waiting to see other estimates, including from Socialist Alternative, from people that were there. But so far, all I got is the Crimson, to be honest. The Globe didn't cover it. The Herald didn't cover it. I didn't have time to get notes from people that were there. I had to miss it for good reason. Wish I was there. I've been at the picket quite a bit. I've been to two rallies where they had easily 400 people there. I've been to a couple picket lines with easily a couple hundred people. Now, the normal picket line in front of one of the dining halls is smaller than that, but they do welcome public support, like I said. So make your way to Harvard, support the strikers, get in touch with Unite here, Local 26. Unite stands for, I'm not even going to get into it, the old needle trades union that merged with, meaning textile workers, merged with hotel and restaurant employees, HERE, Local 26, President Brian Lang, etc. And basically, yesterday you had officials from Local 26, union officials from the Teamsters, from SEIU. SEIU just opened up negotiations at Harvard. The janitors at Harvard have opened up negotiations with Harvard. There's a lot going on in a way in the Boston labor movement. The MBTA workers are fighting privatization. They have there's a Republican governor, and of course, this is no surprise to socialists, but maybe it might surprise some of our liberal friends out there that yes, the Democrats are going along with it. The Democrats, the leader, the Speaker of the House in Massachusetts, which is perennially Democrat, Speaker of the House just came out in favor of lifting the cap on charter schools. And so you have a certain number of Democrats colluding with the Republican governor, or else nothing would happen for the Republican governor, which would be a good thing. Charlie Baker, he's a real man of the people, this guy Charlie. I met Charlie. He affects a real populist, a populist kind of interaction, you know, a little catch in the voice, a little, you know, oh, I'm Charlie. And I met this guy, you know, and I said, hey, Charlie. I didn't say, hey, Charlie. I just said, so what do you think of $15 minimum wage? Because I was holding signs for $15 minimum wage in West Roxbury in Boston, along with some other people from Socialist Alternative and other people that are supporting $15 minimum wage. He goes, I think it's okay the way it is, the minimum wage, which is low in Massachusetts. And it's okay the way it is if you're Charlie Baker, who made millions and millions of dollars off of rationing out health care through an HMO that me and my family are unfortunately a part of or pay into. And Baker laid people off and cut services and made his name as a you know, typical capitalist, bragging about cutting things, you know. So that must work well for government. Come in and cut things, Charlie. Only so he comes in and cuts things that he didn't tell anyone he was going to come in and cut, you know. He didn't run on privatizing the MBTA, privatizing the T, and that's exactly what he's putting all his time into, practically, you know. And it started out with just, there's this little department that counts money, and they're not counting it right, so we're going to give that to Brinks. Well, Brinks is very grateful. This multinational is very grateful that you're giving them this extra job and extra money. And, of course, laying off all these union workers. And now it's coming out that everything he said about it is not true. Well, it's too late. So then they look at the warehouse workers. Oh, warehouse workers. We can do that cheaper. Yeah, sure you can, Charlie. There's warehouse workers around the country. I was involved in an organizing drive. You know, our warehouse workers, they don't get paid crap, and the conditions are absolutely horrible. And it's very Dickensian and very horrible. And yet... he wants everyone, including the union warehouse workers, to be down at that level. Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you, man of the people. And then they're not satisfied going after the warehouse workers. Now they want to go after the bus drivers and bus routes. They want to privatize. And I can tell you, as someone that has researched this stuff, has studied this stuff, oh, my goodness. You privatize, you outsource to the private sector, and you get screwed. The fees, the ticket prices, the service quality, all begins to impact you in ways you didn't imagine. It gets expensive. And there's proof right next door, as part of the whole MBTA thing, is the commuter rail. And if you read the boss's glob, the Boston Globe, you've seen that there's all this stuff going on the last week with the company, the French company, multinational, that is... you know, as they would say in French, les putains, les salopes, that are running this company to the ground. There is horrible service, right? Getting millions of dollars in fines that then the MBTA forgives. So you can forgive the mismanagement to other managers. But if the workers allegedly mismanage something, it's time to go. It's time to ruin lives. It's time to hurt people. That's Charlie Baker, man of the people. So even while the outsourced privatized commuter rail, privatized not fully, but outsourced to a private company, is not working well, and I have coworkers that come in every day and tell me horror stories about that, then what's the answer? Privatize some more. Make other stuff not work well. Make the red line a mess, you know? That's what's going to happen. Make the Mass Ave bus a mess. Or more of a mess. It's a question of revenue. It's a question of lack of will and lack of actual tax money coming in from the super rich and the big corporations in the amounts it used to. And it's misallocation of funds that do exist. Oh, we're going to beef up the Massachusetts Rainy Day Fund, you know, using, you know, for example, toll money from which they're raising tolls on the highways, you know, on I-90 and stuff, instead of it going to increasing T service. And they did a whole thing, which we've talked about on the show before, and I don't have time to go into, where they basically said all of a sudden the state would not fund the T every year, like look at a budget and say, we'll give this much to the T. That's how it used to run, you know? So all the revenue that comes into the state could be used. Any of it could be used for the T, just about. Some was earmarked, but most of it would come in and could be used for the T. One year, I forget what year it was, early 2000s, they basically said, or maybe late 90s, I think it was early 2000s, they basically said, no, wait a minute. The T for now will be funded by a tiny percentage of the state sales tax and by ticket prices and advertising they can get. And they tried to make the T a little business instead of the service that it's supposed to be. Why does the T exist? Even from a business standpoint, because even back in the 19th century, Boston got gridlocked and you had to find a way to get people to work so you can exploit their labor. This is from the business standpoint. And you got to get consumers into stores from the business standpoint back then, to sell stuff. So that so big business got behind this this essentially public service, the MBTA. Now they want to make money off it, and this has happened before with privatization of the trolleys and other stuff back in history. But now they're going after the main thing. And you know, they just might get it because the Democrats really are for it, believe it or not. Don't believe the hype about lesser evilism, because if you look closely, and you don't have to believe me either, read that book I was talking about. I wrote a book review, got published, Listen Liberal by Thomas Frank, the guy that did What's the Matter with Kansas. Read the book review in Socialist Alternative in the newspaper. Read it in... read the book. I'm not the only one. I mean, this is a guy, Frank, who believes in the Democratic Party at a certain level, and yet he says, look at the states like Massachusetts, whole chapter on Massachusetts, Rhode Island, a couple other states and cities, and also some cities like New York, where the Democrats rule in perpetuity. Is that the word? They rule forever, okay? They control the legislature. The governors can't move without them. Yet here in Massachusetts, we get bozos like William Weld back in the 90s, and now this guy Charlie Baker, who somehow managed to destroy a lot of stuff. And guess what? They can't do it on their own. I guess that's creative destruction of the market, you know, which is creative for the people that can escape it into their gated communities or their vacation homes in the Cayman Islands, or when they go check their bank accounts in the Caymans. I mean, every once in a while, they must want to look at their gold, you know, and silver and watch it shine and not just see numbers on a computer screen. But, you know, for the rest of us, that creative destruction destroys lives. It ruins generations. It puts families like my family and my extended family into a perpetual cycle of poverty, not in a perpetual cycle of creative destruction and then regrowth and you know, all that stuff that you learn in college, and that's just all lies, basically. By the way, this is a digression on top of a digression. One of the fallouts of the living wage sit-in, the occupation that needs to happen now for the dining workers, but happened back for a living wage at Harvard in 2000, was that the students in Ec 101, Economics 101, taught by a guy named Manicu, who's a vicious reactionary and economic moron, this guy who's a full professor at Harvard, been there forever, gets his time in the boss's glob for op-eds whenever they want to trash the living the minimum wage and stuff. This guy teaches such right-wing economics, if you want to even call it that, that students rebelled, even like students that like are not at all radical, rebelled and said, we want alternative economic models discussed and presented. We want alternative classes to Manicu's Ec 101, which is a core requirement at Harvard. And they won. I believe they won that. I would have to double check, and God knows if it's still in existence, but I believe they actually won that. And there was such a sigh of relief and such joy over that little side issue. It was really funny. It was like, yeah, we don't have to listen to this guy who has trashed the living wage sit-in back then in 2000. Anyway, getting back to the rally yesterday, and it does come back around, believe me, if you're patient enough to listen. We had a rally for the HUDs. Now, if you hear the acronym or whatever it is, HUDs, the HUDS, that's for Harvard University Dining Service workers, which is a better way to talk about it, is the dining hall workers, members of the union, Unite Here, Local 26. They got together, flatbed truck, 1,000 supporters, marched through Harvard Yard, around Mass Ave, down to Cambridge City Hall. Cambridge Police Department said this was the largest rally yet. I think they're telling the truth on that. Speakers, as I started to say earlier, were a lot of union officials, but also students were there. We have Nicole M. Joseph, a student from Tufts University Labor Coalition, which has done great work here at Tufts. They attended the rally with at least 9 other students in the group. Janitors at Tufts have been in contract negotiations similar to HUD's, Joseph said. Quote, in my time in the university setting, it's been clear how higher education institutions don't treat their workers well. This is something we see on our campus, meaning Tufts, and here at Harvard as well, Joseph said, and she's absolutely right. Diana St. Mark, a University of Hartford dining employee and member of the Connecticut Unite Here, Local 217, said food service contract negotiators are also underway at her university and other colleges across the state. If they're under attack, we're under attack, St. Mark said. Students from Wesleyan, Yale, I know there were students from Northeastern that are in Socialist Alternative were there, and many other students. So it was a brilliant rally, as far as I can tell, in the rain probably as well, or some rain. And will that do the trick? Will that force Harvard to settle? I hope so. But as I said earlier in the show, they're probably not. Harvard is drawing the line here for corporate greed and human misery, because that's what fuels what they do. They don't want to set a precedent by giving this union is putting up a very good fight, very clear demands, very just demands, and people can understand them. People can say that $35,000 a year minimum wage versus $35 billion. Oh yeah, that's a no-brainer, right? Well, Harvard hates that. They much prefer the way my union leadership, for example, negotiates, which I hate, and I've fought them on this. Quiet, back room, and then when the demands do come out, they're so complicated because they have this whole rebranding, repackaging strategy where they make concessions look like victories and concessions that are bad look not so bad, and like they're part of the general zeitgeist. Sure, everyone's got to pay more for healthcare now in the United States. Why? Richest country in the world, and every other industrialized country has public health care, has universal health care, has national health service, has single payer. Look at Canada, right? Canada, poorer than the United States. Healthcare system that's the envy of anyone that knows about it. You'll get stories, I had to wait for this, I had to wait for that. It's all bull. It's right-wingers carping. And the funny thing is, right-wingers up in Canada like the healthcare service. You can go up to Canada. I dare you. Go up to Toronto. Go up to Montreal. Find some right-wingers, man. You'll find some that'll be like, yeah, actually, healthcare is pretty good, you know? They got other rotten things they're talking about, you know? 1964, New Democratic Party, left party, to the left of the liberals, to the left of the conservatives, to the left of Parti Québécois, Parti Québécois. They went and they, just with the threat of this new party, this new left-wing party, bringing up national health care, it sent the other parties in a scramble to support national health care, a national health care system, just to hold power. And the NDP to this day has never held power nationally. It exists still. Goes back and forth between like sort of a social democratic party to a just straight up, unfortunately, liberal party, but it has held power in Ontario, in British Columbia, and so on. Never Canada wide, but it's been enough. Just that threat to the left of the Democrats, a lot of Americans, a lot of liberals, cannot wrap their head around that. As long as you stay with the Democratic Party in the United States, you're not going to have single payer health care. It's not going to happen at all. In fact, you're going to have something worse than what existed before. Obamacare is arguably worse in most respects than the rotten healthcare system that existed before, in the sense that now, if you don't buy into it, you're going to get penalized as an individual. You're going to pay $700-something per year if you don't buy into Obamacare. And the insurance companies involved in Obamacare keep ratcheting up what they charge, and the administration is going along with it. They give out subsidies to some people, but it's all this very complex market-based thing that's basically corporate welfare to these insurance companies. And it's still not enough for the insurance companies. Insurance companies are bailing on it. They're bailing on Obamacare. So the choices you have are less. And the bottom line for a lot of liberals, well, some more people have some sort of health insurance than not, although there's still millions and millions without health insurance. I forget the exact number without health insurance. There's 20 million something without health insurance that should have it, even under Obamacare. But then there's all these people that have it for the first time. And granted, they have some sort of health insurance. I suppose that's better. But remember that movie Sicko by Michael Moore? That movie was about people that already had health insurance and that still got screwed over so badly when they got sick that even with health insurance, they literally died, or their loved ones died, or they couldn't get the care they needed and they couldn't work or were crippled for life, etc. Having a little bit of health insurance, unless you're such a relativist that I just want to like really have a long talk with you, unless you're such a relativist, right, having a little health insurance of whatever quality does not necessarily mean an improvement in your life. It could actually bring headaches that didn't exist before, you know? Like right now, they're ratcheting up. Like I have to pay, for example, one of my kids gets sick and we got to go to an emergency room. We have to pay $100 for an emergency room visit. That makes me think twice, living paycheck to paycheck and all that, of bringing my kids to the emergency room. But you know, if you have kids, you say, screw it, I'm bringing my kids to the emergency room, you know, and I'm going to take that hit, which is really a hit that maybe we won't make the mortgage this month or whatever, you know. And that is wrong. That is so wrong, because some people will especially if they don't have kids, if they're just themselves or something, I could see myself saying, you know, oh, this isn't bleeding too bad. Let's just make that tourniquet a little tighter and we don't got to go to the emergency room and pay $100, you know? I can see people doing that. I know people that do that. I'm avoiding dental care for myself just to not pay. I have dental insurance. It doesn't cover anything hardly. I'm avoiding going to the dentist because of that stuff. And I don't like the pain, I have to admit, but it's not just the pain. So anyway, it's really these kind of choices, these wonderful choices under capitalism, you know, that are talked about so much. Those are choices for the rich. They're choices that are positive. For the poor, for the working class, it's choices that are all negative. Harvard is choosing money over people. That's all it's about. There's been student walkouts. Hundreds of Harvard students have walked out. There was 11 strikers and union leaders got arrested in Harvard Square last week or a week and a half ago. I mean, this is really, really serious stuff. And like I said at the beginning, it's got to escalate, unfortunately. It's all, you know, of course the burden is on us. The burden is on working people. The burden is on the strikers. Nobody's going to help. Some big faculty member, or Hollywood, right? Ben Stiller was on the picket line. Some other celebrities were on the picket line for the Harvard dining hall workers. That's great. I love that stuff, you know? But we don't have any saviors. There's no saviors. There's no one, no individual that's going to help us. It's got to be collective action. It's got to be occupation. It's got to be solidarity strikes. By the way, when I say solidarity strikes, yes, if you're out there, if you're a student of the labor movement or whatever, yes, I know darn well sympathy strikes, a.k.a. solidarity strikes, are completely illegal. The Taft-Hartley Act under Democrat Truman and the Democratic Congress at the time, they passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which outlawed sympathy strikes, solidarity strikes, anything of the nature of like, oh, I see that union's on strike, we should go on strike and support. That's completely illegal. And you know what? So what? Break the law. You have to break the law. You have to break the law. You have to break the law when it comes to social justice and unions, because the law is written by the class enemy. It's written by the big bosses, by the big corporations, by the big CEOs. The law is not neutral. The law is not there to protect anyone except the profits of the big corporations. And guess what? People do break those types of laws successfully when the labor movement's stronger. Most public sector workers, quote unquote, most teachers, for example, are completely forbidden from striking by law. And yet there have been many successful teacher strikes throughout the 70s, 80s, even the 90s, even the Chicago teachers a few years ago, breaking the law. And they're not all thrown in jail. Can't put everybody in jail, as Martin Luther King said. And it works. You know, you have to create new law, but even before that can happen, it has to be civil disobedience. It has to be mass action, and the system can't handle it if it's well organized enough. Speaking of the system, charter schools, privatization. So anyway, support the Harvard dining hall workers. I won't go ahead and read my article over the air. That would be too precious. But again, their demands are modest. That healthcare cost I tried to come up with earlier is in my article. Healthcare costs are already at $281 a month for those with family coverage. Many workers unable to afford being on the healthcare plan at all, et cetera. Just support the strikers. Get out to the picket. Give the union money for them. Give the union, come by, give the workers some food and drink and support. And urge your own union leaders, if you're in a union, I know that not many of us are anymore, but if you're in a union, tell them to support the strikers, go all the way with this to the point of occupation, the point of solidarity strikes. Speaking of going all the way, it's time that we start I'm going to hold off on that for a second. Rhetoric is rhetoric. We're going to get to the meat of things here, the essence. Vote no on question two. If you're from Massachusetts, and again, apologize to our national, international listeners via the magic of the internet and the interwebs and all that. Here in Massachusetts, there's some key ballot questions. Now, some members of Social Alternative and some of my friends and so on would say the key question is question four about legalizing pot in some ways. And, you know, I agree. I want to take that weapon away from the essence of the state, the special armed bodies of men, as Engels said, Friedrich Engels, one of the early Marxists and Marxist theoreticians, said the essence of the state, and I'm paraphrasing, is the special armed bodies of men, the police, the military, and their adjuncts in the court system, in the prisons, and so on. That is the essence of the capitalist state. That is the coercive violence that keeps capitalism running at its root. And that's why it's so important for the capitalists to keep control over the state. And here they do it through the duopoly, the two-party system, two pro-capitalist parties, the Democrats and Republicans. But there are also these things called referendums, these things that can come up in certain states through laws that have been made and won, fought and won for to get a certain number of signatures of support. And then you can put forward a ballot question, a referendum question that people can vote yes or no on. And the one in Massachusetts here, put forward by the Massachusetts Teachers Association. I'm sorry, this first was put forward by a right-wing group to lift the cap on charter schools. Lift the cap on charter schools, meaning there's a limit to how many private schools could be set up that then suck in public money. So it's sort of a form of corporate welfare, a form of privatizing education. And these charter schools are run as businesses using public money, using our tax dollars, and they're run in the way they see fit. So they don't have to take special needs students. They can kick people out. They can do whatever they want. And then they brag about good test scores, which are, by the way, exaggerated and not true in many cases. And I just found out a fun fact. The number of charter school licenses that there are in Massachusetts are not even being fully used. So you got to ask yourself why this group that supports charter schools in Massachusetts, and it, by the way, in other states, and is part of a, big capitalist plot to privatize education, and that is not a conspiracy theory, that is demonstrable fact. They are interested in just getting as many charter schools as they possibly could. It's a propagandistic thing as well as a practical thing. When they get enough money from the legislature, Democrat or Republican or a combination of both, then they'll probably slot those other schools and more, and that's their plan. But right now, there's a lot that aren't even being used, and you want to raise the cap. Huh, that's interesting. Okay. Anyway, we call for a vote no on question two. The Massachusetts Teachers Association calls for a vote no on question two. By lifting the cap on charter schools, even more money, public money, tax money, will get siphoned off into the charter schools, into the privatization of education, into the really, bad education that happens in these charter schools. There's no way around it. I mean, they are just not, they're just not really doing what they claim. They're not these like innovative things or whatever. They're just corporate labs, basically, and they're people making money off of commodifying education rather than seeing education as a service, as a human right. They want to make it a commodity, and this is a step in that direction. Vote no on question two. For more information, go to facebook.com/SaveOurPublicSchoolsMassachusetts, massteachers.org/charters, SaveOurPublicSchoolsMA.com. Get in touch with Socialist Alternative. We'll tell you about it. We'll talk to you about it. We have a member in